everybody, and welcome to another special edition of Digital Shadows Shadow Talk podcast, where we talk to you about cyber threat intelligence and information security. Today, I'm super excited. We have a second time guest joining us. Actually, we haven't had that many repeat guests in the past. And it's just about a year since David was last on with us. But I really want to welcome David Tau Clayton coming to us from Denmark. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's super exciting to be back. And I think most people know why I'm back as well. So
why don't we level set, because I mean, we're Verizon DBIR geeks and I'm very passionate about the report and have been for many years, but why don't you do a level set on your background, you know, where you're at now and your kind of experience, because we'll have new listeners from last time. And then probably people, it was a year ago with the pandemic and the threat landscape. I mean, we forget things a couple of weeks after they happened.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Since last time, and at least a little bit of my background, we first got in touch through the whole the SAM summit, the CTI summit, wasn't it? Was it 2020, I think, or 2021?
It was. It would have been 2020.
Before last.
Yeah, 2021.
Yeah, where I met you. And actually, it was a great time because that was when I introduced the whole the idea of, you know, creating your own DBIR internally in an organization as well. And so my talk there was actually heavily about data science and about bringing data science back to cybersecurity. And then since then, I actually then moved a job after that SANS talk into actually trying to kind of live out my vision of bringing the DBIR to other organizations as well, right? So my SANS talk was kind of about the specific organization that I was in at that time and focusing on how I'd managed to accomplish it there. And then I decided, okay, I really want to go out and try this in a few other organizations and kind of see how applicable this might be in quite a few other different organizations. And I've been doing that for the last year or so. And I think last time, if I remember correctly, on the last podcast, we also said that I'd come back in a year and actually talk about the success of that journey. And so here I am being invited back, which is awesome. So that's a little bit of my background, I think. And for the last year or so, I've been focusing on, I moved into consulting. So I left the organization I was at, moved into consulting, where I've been working on developing cyber threat intelligence capabilities, working very closely with critical infrastructure in Denmark. And it's been quite fun to, where I was at previously was primarily financial focused, whereas here is kind of we're kind of spread out across different critical infrastructure areas. So transport, we've also been in healthcare. So I've had a really baptism of fire of also seeing how all the other different sectors are.
Doing consulting work. Yeah. You really I don't know if this is the best analogy, but I thought about this when I was at Forrester Research, because I would do consulting with all these, you know, in 2 months' time, I might work with 6 or 7 companies or whatever the case may be across all these verticals. It's almost like a dog year analogy. You pick up a lot more breath when you're on the vendor side doing consulting work. Of course, you don't get as deep necessarily as you would if you're just in-house in a particular vertical, but it's a good way to get exposed to a lot of different threats and environments and unique situations.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think actually sometimes those of us that have been really spoiled to be involved in cybersecurity within the financial world, sometimes we can become a little bit detached from what it's actually like in the reality.
And so you don't say.
if you go into consulting and then you don't primarily focus only on the financial world, you go into some of the other sectors which are just as critical, right? Just as critical for society, you know, energy, healthcare. And then see how cybersecurity is being utilized there, then you kind of get a bit more of a, okay, so I really need to adjust my kind of mindset to that, from one maturity to another maturity. And it's not to say that actually there's anything wrong with moving to another critical infrastructure area or anything like that, but it's just the different budgets and how they also tend to make their way into the organization are very, very different. And so you have to kind of adapt as a consultant into that world as well. So
if you go in with expectations of this is a one percenter, you know, large financial institution, and you go into even a regional financial institution, it's not going to be the same resources, capability, maturity, and you have to change your mindset. It's not a bad segue into the Verizon DBIR, because the DBIR is looking at tons of incidents, tons of breaches across a number of different verticals. And it's probably, I think most listeners will be familiar with the DBIR, but let me do a reset on it just in case you're not. Verizon, who's a large, you know, consumer and commercial company, you know, primarily coming out of the United States, 15 years ago, started this report where they were looking at their consulting services and their incident response activities. And they were using a framework that they use called Verus, which is just simply a taxonomy for describing incidents. If you're not familiar with that, we can drop that in the show notes as well. And I think Verus will come up, especially when we get to rolling your own DBIR a little bit later. Yeah. And so originally, I think when they first started off, I think it took 3 years of data for them to actually put together their first report, so they would have a statistically valid sample size to do their data on. And so they started looking at all these, what are the trends that we're seeing? What are the actors doing? What are their motivations? What are the techniques that they're using? And it's evolved over the years. And I think everybody would agree, it's probably the preeminent annual threat report that comes out of the cybersecurity community.
Go
ahead.
No, I was going to say, I recommend actually to a lot of organizations that I go into when they start saying, okay, you know, how do we start utilizing cyber threat intelligence in our day job? Then the first thing I do is say, okay, have you seen the DBIR? Have you started to look at that? I know that there are some criticisms of it sometimes about, bias and things like that, but it's still the best source. I mean, there was like, I think this year, was it 29,000 plus incidents or breaches that were analyzed or something like that?
It looks like it's 23,896 security incidents, of which 5,212 were confirmed data breaches.
Yeah, so that data set is just incredible to be able to start kind of looking at patterns and doing some analysis over the top. So if you're going to read one report each year, it's going to be this one. There's so much interesting stuff in here, I think.
Yeah, I think you could easily see graphs, and they have really nice, I mean, it's a top-notch, well-produced report, but easily these graphs, graphics and the data can make it into your, you know, 2023 planning, you know, decks and things along those lines, or even for initiatives that, you know, maybe need to get bumped up on your priority list. You can look at things there. I think it's a good tool at both a security leader perspective, but I also think at a security practitioner level as well, there's good data in it. And I can't remember the exact number of contributors. I know it's someplace in the report, but the Verizon team did say earlier this week that they had the most contributors that they've ever had before. And of course, Digital Shadows has now contributed the past 3 years, which we're super excited about because, you know, I'm a fanboy for this report, but I also like to try to give, you know, data back. So we've contributed data around dark web markets, dark web forums. Now they don't really attribute the data in the report to specific vendors. So I don't know precisely what from us was pulled in, but there was other providers in the space as well. So they'll put that together. But I would think a lot of the stuff that they have about the dark web specifically comes from Digital Shadows. The report is a long report. You know, it's 108 pages, including the appendices. So it's definitely, I mean, David, you and I were talking about this on our planning call. You know, I'd spent a couple hours the night before it launched going through it and drew some conclusions. But, you know, I did a webinar with Verizon on Tuesday, a CISO panel, and I had other thoughts that came up. I think in our conversation, we'll have other thoughts. So it is my joke and stuff I put out is kind of like a Marvel movie or a Star Wars movie. Is like very rewatchable because you'll pick up different things every time you read through it.
Exactly. And actually, the cool thing was that you were kind of my, so the report came out, and then I actually traveled across Denmark for a customer visit. And so I didn't quite get chance to start, you know, digesting the report. And so I kind of had to rely on some of the people that I trust to do some analysis themselves first. And you were one of the people that I was sat as a fanboy following your Twitter all day, like, okay, what's he saying? What's he saying? What's he saying? I've got to keep up with those comments. But I think you also touched on it, right? That there's 108 pages in this report. And the cool thing, I mean, one of the coolest things I think is how accessible this report is for like all sorts of different layers of an organization, right? There's something for executive management. There's something you said as well for kind of if you need to start planning for what you're going to use your cybersecurity budget on for the next coming year. I mean, you could just look on the first page about this summary of findings and see that, okay, most actors are abusing stolen credentials and things like that. They're so fast. So the graphs just kind of straight in. And not only that, the whole industry focus as well. So one of the first things I did when I got the report was, okay, I looked at the first page and then I went straight down to the customer that I was at. What industry are they in? To see, okay, has there been a change in this specific industry as an example? So I think you've already explained that we are ginormous fanboys of this report each time it comes out. So, and I know the crew behind it, they do absolutely spectacular job of setting up the data and doing the data science behind it. And they're very good at also one of the kind of the key things for us in terms of cyber threat intelligence is also acknowledging their biases and they really do.
They call out the data and they highlight that. I think it's a good, there's a lot of things that if you're doing reporting for your company, I mean, certainly for cyber threat intelligence providers, you know, having, you know, this is the data, this was the sample size, this was the, you know, being, they're very transparent about their data and they're transparent about their gaps. They're transparent. In fact, on the webinar that I was on, you know, there's a North American slant to a lot of the data. And there's also, it's been growing in Europe as well. But once you get into some of the other regions, you know, they're looking for partners to supply data, you know, for Asia Pacific, for Latin America and the Caribbean as well. So they highlight that, like our data set isn't as strong there. One interesting point that Alex Pinto, who runs the overall team, made on the webinar we did on Tuesday was he said that because healthcare is so regulated and has so many breach disclosure requirements that they have found that the healthcare sector and the incident patterns that happen there are almost a canary in a coal mine, because they will see the other sectors start to follow healthcare because healthcare has no choice but to be public with a lot of their disclosure. So the more regulated you are, you know, the and I think that's the challenge. Everyone knows this, like unless you're in regulated industry, obviously GDPR is quite pervasive and you have to do your notifications and things along those lines. But there's so much, it actually ties into one of the key points for me as you look at the key summary of findings was they talk about ransomware, and ransomware was responsible. Let's see, what did it say? What's the number yet? I want to make sure I got it right. It was up 13% over last year. And it's the biggest rise that they've had in 5 years. And so right now, 25% of their breaches were ransomware related. And that to me, the note I put is like, that's just the reported ones. Going back to that disclosure point, there are so many ransomware incidents that don't get reported. And, you know, we track the ransomware actors. We track their PR sites or their press blogs and that sort of stuff. But we work with customers a lot. And you may have seen this in your consulting that they get extorted, but it never makes it up to Happy Blog or to whatever, you know, the blog du jour is from the ransomware actors, because maybe they don't want law enforcement in on the mix at that point publicly. Yeah. And they're just working directly with the victim organization.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I don't know how it is in the US, but over here in Denmark, we have this data regulator who, and I've heard from others that it's quite forward thinking the way they're doing it here, that if any organization in Denmark at all has a confirmed data leak, so the leak of any sort of personnel data, GDPR related data, it has to be reported within a very short period of time. And actually the data regulator here, they actually publish some of these numbers. So they actually have a few graphs that are actually DBIR like in their data science approach to this. But the problem is it's heavily biased in terms of ransomware, because of course, when you have a ransomware one, you're forced to report it, right? Because then you know you have some sort of leak. So again, there is some sort of kind of intrinsic bias in the, I mean, if you look at the graph on the first page of DBIR, you can kind of see the rise in ransomware as it kind of escalates up. But as you've pointed to, you've got sectors like healthcare, which are heavily regulated, where they're kind of really forced to report this type of stuff when it happens. But there'll be others who maybe aren't. There's a lot of silent stuff going on as well, right? So this rise in the numbers here is maybe not as pronounced as it could be if there was also if there was more, if other areas are being highly regulated as healthcare, as an example. And I know that the DBIR, they also publish a healthcare specific report as well, right? Isn't there, because of the sheer number of healthcare things that are being reported.
What did you see? What were some of the interesting nuggets that you found in the report?
I think actually, also actually kind of staying on the first page to some degree as well, is that I've been talking a lot recently and doing kind of a lot of the work that I do is also in kind of CTI analysis, and then going and making recommendations to some of our customers about what they could do in terms of prevention, what they could do in terms of protection, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, we've seen this trend in the industry, or all of us have seen it. So coming out of DBIR, I was not necessarily surprised, but it was just a really good backing of what I already had kind of seen, which is this, the rise of stolen credentials and the rise of that, the usage of that, where I thought that was really interesting and really, really clear as well, that, we have this big issue with credential management and why it's so important when we tie it together with, the rise of certain cybersecurity services like attack surface management, understanding what you've got in your perimeter, and then understanding that you're not just a target from exploitation of zero days or public facing vulnerabilities or something else. I mean, if you also have an SSL VPN that people can log into, you also have an attack surface there, right? And it's very clear in this report that people are, that there's a, that, I mean, look at the difference between the credentials, which is what, almost 50% on the first page versus the, I mean, it's like 10% of exploitation of vulnerabilities as well. And that's crazy, right? It kind of points to that exact same thing when I go out and say, the actors are moving into areas where it's double as hard to detect, right? You mean someone logging in on an SSL VPN portal with what I would say is looks like a legitimate set of credentials. Of course, they're illegitimately gained, but they look legitimate. It doesn't raise as much noise as suddenly exploiting a public-facing vulnerability and, you pop a shell on a server. So actors have also realized this.
It's the whole living off the land. Living off the land continues.
Exactly. And I mean, you can see this, and you can also see that it talks into the next thing around the rise in ransomware as well, and how successful it's being. It points a lot into some of the recommendations that I've been making recently about, looking at your credential management. What are you doing with things like this and trying to actually prevent this type of stuff from happening? So kind of maybe not many surprises, because I think a lot of us have our fingers on the pulse in terms of the stuff that's going on month, but in terms of backing up what we've been saying, I think it's a really good good report for doing that this year, definitely. I don't know what was interesting for you.
Well, the very first thing I wrote down on my iPad when I was reading this was the more things change, the more they stay the same. And the report calls back to a bunch of 2008 data, and a lot of the things that they had there is still going on today as well. And it's credentials, it's phishing, it's unpatched vulnerabilities. It makes me think, RSA conference is coming up in the US in San Francisco week after next, and I don't look forward to going onto the expo floor, and I bet I'm gonna see autonomous SOC and AI. Yeah,
next generation SOC, right? SOC 2,
yeah,
SOC 3.0.
It's just, it's to me, it's just a bunch of I don't know, distractions for organizations. And I do get and appreciate, especially as a practitioner now versus being kind of a consultant slash industry analyst before, like it is hard to roll out multi-factor authentication across your entire estate, particularly if you're a global company and you've grown through acquisition. You know, that's just saying that you need to roll out MFA is like, oh, thank you, Captain Obvious. There's a very long tail to be able to doing it. Yeah. But these things like rolling out MFA, tightening RDP, like they talk about desktop software. Like if there's one thing, and we see this in how we track the initial access brokers, I mean, RDP, VPNs, all these external services, you know, lock them down as much as you can, like who can even access them, put services behind VPNs, make sure the VPNs have multi-factor authentication on them, make sure it's a good form of MFA as well. You know, it's not just SMS.
Exactly. That was that's a very key point there. I think that was one of the things where I was out yesterday saying about, you know, the fun thing is it's not just MFA you need to look at. If you look at the things that Lapsus were doing with the whole, you know, getting people to swipe in the middle of the night and things like that, it's looking mm-hmm. at good forms of MFA as well.
MFA alone is not enough. I also made a note that I think like this report just highlights, you know, the move towards passwordless security and killing the password as well. But, you know, I mean, we see that stuff. I mean, we have a whole, you know, kind of account takeover service that we offer. So on the cred side, on the phishing side, you know, phishing has been here forever. I used to cover email security at Forrester as well. You know, and there are things that you can do, like, you know, putting tags on external emails that are out there. In fact, on the email side, this isn't phishing, but the report talks about still one of the main causes of OOPSEC, as I like to call it, is accidentally emailing, I meant to send this to David that works at Digital Shadows and I send it to you instead. And it's got a bunch of sensitive data. Like it's that whole accidental bit there. But, you know, phishing is nothing new. And then, of course, the vulnerabilities. I mean, like we know, and you go back to Hafnium, you go back to March of last year, and what was it? 3 Microsoft Exchange, you know, exploits that were getting targeted. And there was still a long tail for patching them. So I don't think there was a ton of, you know, shocking things to read in here, but I think there's enough evidence if you're struggling in your organization to try to use this as a tool to try to move the needle and to be able to implement more things.
Exactly. Definitely. 100% agree.
Well, any on the vulnerability front, so this is kind of the next step of the conversation. You actually made me aware of this. I hadn't picked it up, but there's some really cool research that just came out last week, week before last, on APT groups. It was from University of Cornell, and their targeting of 0 days versus known exploits. Why don't you tell us about that a little bit? Because it I don't know that it's shocking to some people, but to I think a lot of people, it may very well be.
Yeah, so I picked this up when I was actually looking for research in terms of backing the whole why we do patch management, right? So if I was going to go out and talk to an organization, explain, okay, you know, patch management is also really important. And again, just to highlight something you said about going onto the RSA Expo floor and like patch management isn't sexy, but we have to do it anyway, right?
Guaranteed. AI, there will not be flashing lights at RSA, like patch management here, patch management here.
Exactly. There'll be some sort of blockchain driven AI next generation SOC, but most people aren't thinking, okay, you know, the best way we could do this is actually just patch management. And actually, the DBIR does a really good thing about looking at it, but there was also a really awesome science paper that actually came out, which kind of maybe dropped under the radar on some people's thing, but I caught it, and I can't remember exactly how I caught it, but it came out, it was by Cornell University. I think you'll put it in the show notes, right? So others can have a look at it. And what they did was they basically looked at a data set of APT attacks between 2008 and 2020. And I mean, we can all sit and pick apart the the data foundation that they used to do this. But again, it was still quite a large amount of campaigns, and it was 350 campaigns that they analyzed. So there's a good amount of data in there to be able to start drawing some interesting conclusions. And what they looked at was specifically in terms of the vulnerabilities, the attack vectors. And when they found APT groups that were then exploiting a vulnerability, they then looked at, okay, is this a zero day or is this a an already out there public vulnerability? And there's some really interesting conclusions that they draw. And even literally in the summary, they raise this thing that, and it was something that I put in my talk, I think it was yesterday, that zero days being a dying art in the APT world. And actually this really kind of points into that, where they basically make the statement that most APT campaigns actually ended up employing publicly known vulnerabilities, the stuff that was already out there in the public domain. And then they make this really interesting statement, which I thought was really useful, that I used in one of my talks, which is if an enterprise could theoretically update as soon as an update is released, it would face lower odds of being compromised than those waiting. And then they say 1 month. So if you waited 1 month, there was a measurement of your risk of being compromised was 5 times greater. And if you waited 3, it was almost 10 times greater. So this is like, there was someone at the front of my talk who was definitely in the patch, the release management team, because their eyes just lit up and they were like, yes, this is exactly what I was looking for. And then they came up to me and I was like, can I have access to that paper? And yeah, I mean, it's not rocket science stuff, right? It's, again, it's that kind of, we all kind of knew this, but sometimes it takes data science to come and kind of more draw to some of these conclusions and say, I've got some really, really factual stuff here based on science.
Or it takes somebody else. Because I think exactly. A lot of, there's a reason why people pay consultants to come in, because in many organizations, part of the value of a consultant is they're saying the same thing that you're saying, except they have, whatever the consultant's, business card, logo is to kind of support what your efforts are. I should ask Dave from the DBIR team. I don't know which report it was, but it was probably one that was 8 or 9 years ago, something along those lines. But they had a comment along the lines of, it was talking about espionage actors, to use the way DBIR talks about it. And they're saying espionage, like, why use a cruise missile when the screen door is wide open? Right. And this was, 7, 9 years ago, whatever DBIR version that it was. And, this data driven piece, which is 20 pages long, and there's some, it's an academic piece, but there's nice nuggets in there. Again, like, why do I, if I have a tasking from whoever controls my, intrusion operations, why do I want to develop some, there are certainly cases like Equation and NSA is probably a good one. Like, there are certainly some of these, very powerful tools that are used, top tier actors and things like that. Like, that is there. But if you can live off the land and save your resources for a hard target, something like that, then do that. So we'll put this one in the show notes. But I think if you're, well, I was about to say if you're struggling with vulnerability management, but then I was like laughing, because what practitioner does not struggle with vulnerability management?
The endless struggle.
We just kicked off one of our agent-based scans, and I'm like, okay, here comes another thing. Or CISA here in the US just released, they've done 2 drops this week of known exploited vulnerabilities that are out there, which is actually not a bad resource. Its data set is more US centric, but CISA is seeing the data that they're picking up from their different resources, government agencies, intelligence community. And then they're like, here's what you need to do to patch. Like, there was actually one that came out yesterday, yesterday being Tuesday, the 24th, was on the Cisco ASAs. But being able to tie into assets, I mentioned this, the DBIR has a brief section on assets, but where I think to make your vulnerability management more scalable is to be able to say, here's the vulnerability source. It could be CISA, maybe it's something ASD is giving out in Australia, whatever the source of, here's what's being exploited, and then be able to quickly ascertain, do I have assets that look like this? gets to the attack surface management kind of bit, and then you kind of prioritize that. I mean, to me, the vulnerability game is really about prioritization. Exactly. You're on the hamster wheel forever.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the point you made about the going back to the cruise missile thing, I mean, even if we kind of step back from that and look at that, like you can see that literally on the first page of the DBIR where they these like stolen credentials, right? Like, what's the point in coming up with a magical way of exploiting SSL VPN server if you can just log in with you know, Joe from finance's account? Like, there's no need to be launching 0 days anymore when you can just log in with that and also not get caught, right? That's the other really, really interesting thing about this.
I'm cracking up. I'm just looking at a tweet that I sent out yesterday, but I saw this article. It was the Interpol Secretary General was talking about his concern that state developed cyber weapons will become available on the dark net. And I just kind of LOL'd when I read it, but my tweet was like, read the DBIR. Instead of focusing on commercial, I'd focus on commercial grade RDP over derp web cyber bombs. And you hear this AI, like, why do I need to use AI if I can go use OpenBullet? I can get a list of credentials very cheaply, and then I can just brute force your accounts. Like, I don't need to use cyber AI that I bought on the derp web.
Exactly. And I really hope that like this year's DBIR, and I hope that these are the resources that others use to kind of back up the same things. Like, I mean, when we're talking, we know this like inside out, but I really hope that this year's DBIR can start to back up some of those claims a little bit more, right? And so it's not just an echo chamber of us kind of stood there.
Like, I know, that's like, the risk. You know,
yeah, exactly. Like, you need to do this, and then you've got this flashy sales guy in a suit being like, no, you need to be on the blockchain. Like, okay, how is that actually going to help me? Yeah, you don't need to worry about patching blockchain. And then of course we know, but the problem is that the people that are on that strategic level, they really haven't understood the importance of data science in their own organization as well. And I think this kind of
Well done.
I think this kind of links into exactly why I was brought on here, right? Is to also say, like, why is it that we are here talking about the same things over and over again? And at least from what I've been doing for the last year with this whole kind of roll your own DBIR thing, what I have discovered is actually the problem is that most organizations don't actually understand that they're sitting on an absolute goldmine of CTI themselves, right? We all say this, right? There's no better CTI than that you have yourself, right?
Buy any external, I mean, and I am a CTI provider, but I would tell you before you spend money on digital shadows, make sure you're taking advantage of your own data. Know your collection capabilities, know your gaps. We can help fill some gaps for you. And there is a place for the external side to feed in, but if you're not taking advantage of what you already have, then I'd say you're not maximizing what you could be doing, and you're not telling a story that's not the Wall Street Journal headline that you're chasing. It's here's what we see in our own environments. And I used to do this hand raising exercise, or I still do, I guess, when I used to present in person. And I think I've done one so far in-person presentation since the pandemic, but I'd always do a hand raising exercise. Like, how many people are familiar with the DBIR? How many people do their own version of the DBIR, or how many people do their own, whatever it is, maybe it's not on Verisk, but you're at least using your own data set, and very few hands would come up. So, you know, this is what we talked about last year. And so now it's almost like a check-in, like you wanted to go and apply this beyond your own organization. So how do you get started with it? You know, what's your easy button or your on-ramp, if you will, to trying to do this?
Yeah. So the thing that I've kind of discovered, and it's almost kind of linked to what you just said as well about when I go into an organization, even if it's kind of in the like, okay, we're trying to make the sale part, you know, linking up with the customer at the start or whatever, like usually part of what I'm saying is, okay, have you read the DBIR, right? Again, like you said, and if they say yes, then I say, okay, you know, have you thought about what this means for you as an organization? And yeah, okay, yeah, we thought about where we need to invest our budget based on what they're saying. And I'm like, okay, but have you thought about being able to compare this to your own organization, not just your feeling, but actually, you know, you can make something similar to this yourself, right? It's not that you've got the data, you've got the incidents that are occurring, so you could make this yourself. And a lot, my finding there is actually that, I don't know if it's we've failed as a cybersecurity industry or whatever it is, but like the kind of light that kind of ticks on when you kind of have that conversation to show them that, look, give me the last 10 incidents that you've had as an example. Just go get me the last 10 and let's look at some analysis of those 10. And then we use a framework like Verisk, which is, for anyone who doesn't know, is the language that's used behind the DBIR. It's a really incredible language. If anyone's interested in reading up on it, there's the Verisk community, which will be in the show notes, I think. Sorry, I'm just taking your role here, Rick. But
No, it's making it easy.
There's a, you know, then apply the Verisk language, and as soon as you kind of bring this even to those 10 incidents that they might have brought up, and you start just digging into, okay, what actions is it you've been seeing? Okay, you've seen some social engineering cases. Great. So we suddenly got a picture and across 10 incidents that you've had that, okay, you know what, you've got an issue with social engineering because all 10 have been social engineering. Suddenly the world opens up to them when they're like, oh, wait, hang on a second, I am sitting on a goldmine of this stuff. You know, our service now is filled with cybersecurity incidents. And what you also then find is that you go into their service now, you go into their ITSM, whatever system they're using, and then you find that actually they've just used the same form for their service now that the service desk is using. And it doesn't necessarily match very well with cybersecurity cases, but what you find is that the incident handler has been really good to write up some of the notes inside the description field, right? And as we know from doing data science, it's really crap to just get, you know, 10 incidents with a description field. You can't really work very well with it. You have to do a lot of manual work. And I think I had one customer that gave me like 400 incidents or 400 cases, and I had to manually go through a lot of them and just kind of give check marks. But once I'd done that and done the conversion, suddenly I had like 400 cases that I could show them where there was like an incredible story of what was going on in their organization. And so when I then presented the report back to them, I was able to say, look, guys, you know, the DBIR is based on 23,000 cases. Here you've got like 400 of your own. Now you've got a way of kind of, I wouldn't say one-to-one mapping, because of course there are some little nuances in it, but at least still you can start to compare. And not only that, one of the key things that you can do is then say, okay, if you've got incident data going back 6 months and you know in those 6 months you've invested in a new cybersecurity tool or whatever that is, being able to see, has this tool actually had an impact in the number of overall incidents we're seeing, the number of true positive incidents, all those types of things, by bringing things like Verisk into use and just applying a very basic set of data science kind of principles, boom. Suddenly there's just this enormous kind of realization that, whoa, wait a second, we've got all this data in internally. Well, yeah, like you don't need to buy the next AI tool. You just need to focus on a bit of data science, and suddenly there's this just
it's a really good point. Instead of going to RSA and buying an AI tool, stand up a data capability on your own team, and then use that to, like, it can help you with a narrative as well. Like, okay, maybe you can't scale it out, and maybe it's baby steps, but your example about having a tool. So, you know, maybe you're seeing, I don't know, a certain type of fish working and you implemented it. Maybe it's not even buying something, but you implement a new tool. Hey, we disabled macros in Microsoft Office, whatever the case may be. And we did this at this point. And then here we can see a correlation behind changing this process, implementing this tool. This goes down, but then you could get into your budget cycle and you could revisit, like, oh, here we implemented this CFO. You can protect your budget. Like, we've actually seen a demonstrable decrease in, you know, risk, blah, blah, blah there. And maybe you can't do it at this grandiose scale. You have this dashboard, you know, that sort of stuff, but you could at least have a narrative and start with a narrative on it and then iterate and mature it as you go on.
Exactly. And that's kind of the thing that I also go and say is that, like, don't expect to produce 108-page report every month. Like, start basic, right? You know, just count the number of incidents you're seeing and the number of action types and maybe a few other things that you think are interesting from Verisk. And the guys behind the DBIR, they've also done a really good job of releasing a lot of different spreadsheets that you can use, where you can just literally go in.
I was going to ask you, like, tooling wise, you know, where do people start? What do they do? What do you do? Is there a tool that you use or something you have developed?
Yeah, so we talked about this in the prep to the show as well. After this, in the show notes here, there'll also be the basic kind of interpretation of Ferris, and a basic, even a very simple kind of report template that you can kind of get started with. That maybe if you haven't even understood what Ferris is, you can then see, okay, if I'm going to be able to send my CISO or my exec, whoever else is in the exec team, if I'm going to be able to send them a report every month that says, these are the types of cases I've had, then I'm going to need to use a specific language. And actually, this spreadsheet that will go up, I think it'll be on my GitHub, it can help you do that as well, right? But there is also, for those that aren't necessarily interested in that, there's also the Ferris community site. And going in there, they've done some really interesting stuff with looking at example cases and saying that, you know, you can choose to use Ferris to whatever degree you want. So you don't have to choose to use Ferris to the degree that they use in the DBIR. You can choose to only use the action types as an example. And if you get good in 6 months of describing the action types, then you can move on to one step lower, right? And then 6 months, and, you know, eventually you're producing a full-blown DBIR and yeah, like
that you can diff yeah, over time and show trends.
Exactly. And that's the thing that I think that I take from this year's DBIR and all this other stuff is, like, if I could make one recommendation to all the places I go into, it's literally start working with the data that you have before you start investing in something else. You know, I think you also said in the run-up to this that you had brought in a data analyst and you'd seen some big lift in the work that you were doing. And I've seen it as well in places that are using data science. It's just the biggest lift you'll get is from understanding your own cases.
Yeah, 100%. Well, we're kind of at the end. So first off, it's great when people, you know, you love it when you go to a conference talk and someone releases code or a tool or a procedure or something to kind of help, you know, take what could seem as a, especially if you see the DBIR 108 pages, overwhelmed by it, how do I distill that into my own org? So I think it's great that you're going to release and share, you know, this spreadsheet that people can use. We'll put that into the show notes. Is there anything that you want to promote, you know, before we close out today?
I think I can also link this now. Actually, I was thinking about this today after you asked me yesterday. You mentioned that the DBIR is kind of, they acknowledge their bias in terms of the US-based, North America-based data that they have. And the hoodie that I'm wearing, which maybe people won't see because it's on the podcast, but it's from this this group that I'm associated with, which is the called FDCA, and there'll be a link to their site if you want to read up on them. It translates to the Association for Danish Cyber Alumni, and they're working on a new project which is going to be based on actually analyzing Danish-based incidents and then producing data that's mapped to Ferris that we can then actually feed back to the guys who are working on the DBIR. So I actually have quite a lot of them. Since my SANS talk, I've been linked up with quite a few of them and had a lot of really interesting dialogue with them. I had a behind the scenes look on some stuff in the DBIR, and we're trying to link up with them and actually support them as much as possible as well. So try and make Denmark kind of a test bed for, could we kind of build up like a more European capability where we can feed back into the DBIR and support them. So yeah, that's kind of what I'd like to represent at the end, at least that we've got this plan coming. So,
well, big up to that, and we'll drop that in the show notes as well. From me, like, I'm super appreciative to have you come on. I think we've done it 2 years now. Let's do it again next year after the launch, and we can kind of see how, you know, both of us have progressed in our respective roles going forward. So thank you very much for joining us.
Exactly. Thank you very much for having me, Rick. And it's a pleasure as always.
Well, hopefully we'll see each other, I don't know, in a conference in Europe sometime before this time next year. Or maybe you come over for CTI Summit in January in Maryland or DC or Virginia, wherever it will be. So thanks to everybody for listening. I appreciate the time, and stay safe, and look forward to our regular weekly podcast coming soon. Thank you.